From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I had started to interview these people, and some of the folks that I literally had already done interviews with for the proposed book were Maya Angelou. She was still with us, and Bill Cosby. It shows you how different one's life can be in 8 years. And so I then got a television project, and I had to sideline the book. And so maybe about now, 2 years ago, a year and a half, I got the idea to kind of resurrect the idea. And I knew I couldn't use those interviews any longer because they were dated. Time had moved on, obviously, by almost a decade. But I thought the idea of getting our best and brightest influencers and thinkers and leaders together in a virtual conversation would be the thing to do. So I picked up the idea, found a publisher who came on board and loved the idea with me and began these conversations.
Ed Gordon, Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist and author of Conversations in Black on Power, Politics, and Leadership, published by Hachette Books. For more than 30 years, Gordon has had a stellar career in broadcast journalism. His work has been viewed on BET, NBC, MSNBC, and CBS, and heard on National Public Radio and the Steve Harvey Morning Show. In his first book titled Conversation in Black, Gordon takes a comprehensive and unvarnished look at the state of Black America. He brings together a diverse group of today's most prominent African-American voices for a virtual gathering to discuss where African-Americans and the community go from here. With the current state of affairs in this country, at the time of this production, it's uncanny that Gordon has written a book that touches on the issues that America faces today. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Conversations in Black, on Power, Politics, and Leadership with Ed Gordon in Black America.
I didn't want it to just be a conversation. Talking's fine, but action has to follow the conversation if you're going to change things. I did not like the idea of putting the questions at the back of the chapter. That was really my agent and my publisher who wanted to do that. And I will say, I will fall on my sword, that we've heard from a lot of people who said they appreciated those questions at the back of the chapter because it gave them something to start on. You know, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily know how and where to start. I tell people all the time, don't wait on someone. You know, don't sit there and think that you have to have a leader to come to you and show you the way to go, that you are a leader, whether it's in your home or your neighborhood or just with yourself. There are leadership qualities we all possess.
Intelligent, inspiring, honest, hard-hitting, and direct are some of the words that have been used to describe Ed Gordon over his three-decade career, both in television and radio. Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, he is a graduate of Western Michigan University with a degree in communications and political science. He began his career at WTBS, the PBS affiliate in the Motor City. Gordon has worked at BET twice, NBC, MSNBC, CBS, and NPR. In 2012, Gordon began thinking about writing a book all about the conversations he has had with newsmakers over the course of his career. Conversations in Black is the completion of that thought. The book aims to create a new narrative for people of color in their community quest for equality in this country. Speaking with over 40 top leaders and influencers, Gordon's book is a treasure trove of ideas and opinions. Recently, In Black America spoke with Ed Gordon.
Well, you know, Detroit was a town I spent my formative years there, born in 1960. So, you know, grew up through the 60s and 70s in Detroit. And it was a city that really, as you think about where we sit today, gave you a sense of Black pride. You know, it was one of those early cities that had a Black mayor. You had Black professionals, teachers, doctors, lawyers. So, you know, you really grew up with a sense, if you were lucky enough to be born in the right zip code, that you could make it. And it was one of those things that really ran the gamut between those who didn't see college as an option. You could go to, you know, a plant and make a solid middle class living. And then often you saw those parents give their children the next step up and, you know, made sure that they received a college degree. And for those of us whose parents may have already traveled that road, the expectation was that you were going to go to college. And so for me, man, it was really one of those magical places that you saw people of color in positions of power, and you just naturally believe that you could one day be there as well. So I am proud to say that I am from Detroit.
Cass Tech was the forerunner of what we call magnet schools today. What was it like at that experience?
You know, it's funny. Cass was one of those, as you suggest, magnet schools where people from all over the city came. And it is one of the most famous high schools in America. And it's funny because people will say to me, you know, what is it about Cass? I do a lot of stuff with Steve Harvey and was on his radio program not too long ago. And Tommy, his co-host, was saying to me, man, what is it about Cass? You know, everybody that comes out of there is successful. And while that's not quite true, I will say that Cass was one of those schools, again, that gave you the belief that you could be successful, that you could compete with anyone. You know, it wasn't anything magical in the water. It wasn't anything that can't be duplicated. There was just a sense of and an expectation of you will do, you can do, and that the fact that you had to test into that school made you believe that you could do all of the things that your teachers were telling you that you could do. And so a lot of it was simply environment and the sense of expectation that you will succeed, and it rubbed off on all of us, I think.
Now, Michigan is a state with top rate colleges and universities. Why Western Michigan?
So for me, it was simply this. While I got into Cass, I didn't always take Cass seriously. And so Western Michigan was one of the schools that I could get into relatively easily and went into a summer program. It was called the MLK program, the Martin Luther King Jr. program, for students that they wanted to see if they could handle the rigors of college. And I knew that I could handle it, and I knew that my grades were more reflective of me hanging out than my abilities. And so being who I was, I said after taking, you were supposed to do the summer semester, and then they would see what your grades were and see how, you know, serious you were about it. So it was two semesters of the program. You had to do the summer semester and a full year of what they required you to take. And so they were really, really easy classes, almost like basket weaving or some crap like that. And I said to them, I said, look, my mother is paying for this. I don't have time to take these kinds of courses. I tell you what, let's make a deal. I said, if I get above a 3.5 in the summer semester and the first semester of the fall, can I get out of the program where I can now pick my own courses and design my way through this? And so they said yes, to their credit, and I was able to move forward. But, you know, those programs are truly important because there are a lot of kids who don't have the opportunity. They have the smarts, but they don't have the opportunity to test into colleges. Perhaps they may not have had the kind of school that gives you the foundation, yet your fortitude allows you in. So that's really why I went to Western. It was a fact of not choice, but that's kind of where I could go. I began to take a look at the University of Michigan as a transfer, had put paperwork in and was going to go there. But I tell you, man, I stayed at Western. It was a smaller school, and it really gave me everything that I needed. And I tell people all the time, you know, a degree from Harvard is fine. It certainly gives you certain opportunities that others don't have and networks that others don't have. But I think of somebody like Dan Rather, who went to Sam Houston University. It really isn't the university as much as the person, you know, that kind of brings you to the height of success. There are a lot of people that never went to college who become uber successful. So I try to tell young people, think less about the school than it is the effort you're putting into it.
Obviously, Mr. Gordon, you've had a stellar career thus far. So what was that initial impetus for journalism?
I thought that I either wanted to be a lawyer, and that was kind of my first love, or a journalist. I would always pretend and watch the guys on the local news and people on the national news, and I'd be in the lunchroom pretending like I was giving a newscast in junior high school. But really, my first love was the law, and thought I wanted to be a lawyer simply because, you know, that was what was cool on TV. And then I graduated from high school and then graduated from college. And really, had taken the LSAT, or prepared, I should say, for the LSAT and, you know, the pre-law exam, and was looking and thinking about law school. But I didn't relish the thought of going back to school. I was so sick of school. And my cousin, who was in law school at the time, used to come to my mother's house on the weekends to get a home-cooked meal. And while he was in law school, he literally, we'd see him Friday, he'd eat Friday night dinner. And the only time we'd see him come out of our basement was to eat. I mean, his, you know, nose to the grindstone in those books. And I was like, man, I don't want to do this. So I spent a year with no job. My job really was getting out with my boy throwing the baseball in front of his mama's house. We did that like it was our job one summer. And I said, dude, if we don't stop doing this, we're going to be doing this at 50. And so I volunteered at the public broadcasting affiliate in Detroit. My brother's old girlfriend worked there, though she wasn't speaking to him anymore. She did still like me. So she got me in as an intern. And I just, from that point on, worked my butt off until they hired me. And, you know, I just kept kind of climbing that ladder, telling people I wanted to do. I was one of those eager people who wanted to maybe even do more than they were equipped to do. But to all of the credit who were the early people in my life by means of career, many of them saw how much I wanted it and just gave me opportunity and shared their wisdom with me. And that took me from being an intern to a fortuitous opportunity to host a show and then take over that show when the talent left. And then from there, I went to BET and have been running ever since.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Ed Gordon, Emmy Award-winning journalist, talk show host, and author of his first book, Conversation in Black, on Power, Politics, and Leadership. Mr. Gordon, 2012, you began this project. What was it about 2012 that led you to write this book?
It wasn't anything about the particular year. And the reality is, the idea came to me in 2012 of trying to do a conversation with all of the people that I've been able to talk to over the course of my career. You know, I've kind of made a name for myself for interviewing folks. And I said, man, wouldn't it be great if I could get some of these people in the same room and write a book as if we were holding a conversation? And so Clinton had just been killed and Barack Obama was going into second term. And I had started to interview these people and some of the folks that I literally had already done interviews with for the proposed book were Maya Angelou. She was still with us, and Bill Cosby. It shows you how different one's life can be in 8 years. And so I then got a television project and I had to sideline the book. And so maybe about now, 2 years ago, a year and a half, I got the idea to kind of resurrect the idea. And I knew I couldn't use those interviews any longer because they were dated and time had moved on, obviously, by almost a decade. But I thought the idea of getting our best and brightest influencers and thinkers and leaders together in a virtual conversation would be the thing to do. So I picked up the idea, found a publisher who came on board and loved the idea with me and began these conversations. And so the book reads as if we're all talking together in one room, though none of us were. I was kind of the linchpin to everyone.
Right.
And each chapter is a different topic. And Johnny, the ironic thing is I wrote the book because even in 2012, I thought Black America was in need of new narratives. Mm-hmm. I thought we'd reached a plateau and that America really wasn't listening to us anymore. And some of the things that we were demanding, America was turning away, and we seemingly, in my mind, had been trying to get America to listen with the same tactics. And so I thought some of our leadership had become a little stale and staid, and the approaches that we took to try to continue down this road to justice. And now the irony is the book couldn't be any more relevant if I had planned it, because all of what we talk about in the book is exactly what's being talked about now, from police brutality, to our representation in business and in corporate America, to our images on television, to the importance of the 2020 election, to the effect that Trump has had on Black America. We reflect on the Obama years. We even have a chapter called Am I Black Enough for You? Because what I'm encouraging us to do is we're asking whites to take a look at how they view us and treat us. I would say the same to our community. You know, we're still caught up in what's authentically Black and who decides if you're Black enough. And I think we need to, you know, take a real look at how we defined what Black is. In the book, I say, and I've said this for many years, you know, we're still very much into that light skin, dark skin thing. But if it's simply melanin and hue, then what you're saying is Clarence Thomas is blacker than Louis Farrakhan. And I'll take that bet any day if you want to go with that. So, you know, we've tried to be very honest about what we talk about in this book. And the one thing that I will say, and the lineup, as you know, Johnny, is tremendous, the people we were able to bring to the table. But I was just very appreciative that everybody was very candid and very honest about what we talked about.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. Now on with our conversation. Why was it important for you to have old school and new school, meaning you have a younger generation train of thought, but then you have some of the old vanguards?
Well, because that's the reality of who we are as a people. I mean, you know, we run literally in that book from somebody like T.I. and Killer Mike to, you know, pundits like Angela Rye and Tiffany Cross and Bakari mm-hmm. Sellers. To, you know, mainstream traditional leadership, people like Maxine Waters and Stacey Abrams and Al Sharpton and Mark Morial and Derek Johnson of the NAACP. And, you know, I tried to even get the right-leaning folks like Michael Steele or right. just in any number of folks that we were able to sit down. Over 40 of our best and brightest are in the book. And I just felt like it wouldn't be a fair representation of who we are if we simply talk to, you know, those over 45 who have traditionally been our leadership. You know, what we're seeing in the streets today shows this movement that we're in the midst of today doesn't happen without young people. And what we're seeing now is it's going to take all of this that we have. You know, we always talk about not being a monolith. And so I didn't want it to be monolithic. So, you know, we hear from Eric Holder in the book, but we also hear from Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how at one point, you know, the Obama administration, she felt, was being a little tone deaf to police brutality and what was going on. And so, you know, I say it's very honest. I found that, and I've found over my lifetime, and you know this, having interviewed so many people, you know, people tend to be more honest, quite frankly, before that microphone comes on. And when the microphone comes on, they start to think, oh, what's politically correct? So in doing this, and I've always been blessed to have people be probably as honest as they were going to be, you know, when I've sat down with them. But I will say this time, I think they were even more honest because there's no red light. There's no microphone in front of them. It was really just Ed and that person either face to face or on a telephone doing these interviews. And they were a bit more open, I think, than they may have been had there been a camera there.
During this process of interviewing these individuals, were there any aha moments that kind of caught you off guard from one of the individuals you spoke with?
Not necessarily aha moments. I mean, because I'm so steeped in many of these topics, there was nothing that I wasn't expecting. But I think what is an aha moment is the candor of, you know, these folks. As I said, I think about what Harry Belafonte said. And you know, he made it clear in no uncertain terms that he felt that Barack Obama didn't do enough for Black people, you know, when he was in office. You know, the candor of some of the young guard feeling still, and this is no surprise, that's why I say it's not an aha moment, but still feeling like, as every generation finds, that when it's their turn, when it's their next person up, the old guard doesn't want to let go of the reins very easily. I think the old guard felt they had a better relationship with the young guard than vice versa. And while they still appreciated one another and respected one another to a degree, I think, like most generations, each thinks that they have the best way to move us forward. And I think what'll be interesting as we look at how life is playing itself out now is, with all of these disparate voices we have out here representing Black America, how do you find common ground and bring some of those voices together? And then if you can't come together, how do you respect that, okay, you take that lane and I'll take this lane, as long as we're shooting for the middle and what's best for all of us? You know, how do you keep that going without stepping on one another or getting in one another's way and allowing that fight to sidetrack the bigger fight? And that is from, you know, America in and of itself, and white America specifically, to finally say, look, we've still, after all these years, been unjust to a people, and we want to try to correct that.
I find it interesting when you just articulated that in the book, you somewhat clarify activism and what activism looked like. Obviously, being clairvoyant to a certain extent, you hit the hammer on the head of the nail.
Well, I wish I could give it to clairvoyance, because I would play the lottery later on today if that was the case. But I will tell you that it was just a feeling, a gut feeling that I had. And it was also just having conversations with different people and listening. And so I felt there was some loosening of the undergird that has kept us for this long. I felt kind of bubbling tension in America just in general. I felt a sense of Black America is tired of being underpaid, underlistened to, undervalued, underappreciated. That our lives didn't matter in the same way. And it didn't take a rocket scientist to really sit back and realize that there was something that was going to snap us. I could never have predicted it would be George Floyd and that incident, but it wasn't hard for me to see that we were on that road, which is why in talking about, there's a chapter on Black men, you know, right. There's an issue with Black men, not only with police and being killed, and it's not just with young Black men, but there is also, as we all know, unfortunately, a problem in us respecting ourselves and the killing that goes on in our communities. But it's not the simple kind of write-off that America has given, and that is just that young Black men are wild and violent and all of those things. No, that's misguided to believe that. It's all of the things that we're talking about now that brought those young Black men to that place. And so, you know, when you see the death of someone like Kobe Bryant or Nipsey Hussle, Nipsey we talk about in the book, and the kind of personification of who they were and how they were seen by young Black men, all wanting, I think, most wanting to attain that level of success, maybe not from a dollar perspective, but just from a sense of being able to change your life. You know, the young Kobe Bryant that came into the NBA was not the same Kobe Bryant who retired and had become a father and had found a different kind of responsibility. You know, the young Nipsey Hussle who started in the rap game and ran with gangs and was not the one that we unfortunately lost on that fateful day. You know, there is a sense of growth that needs to be talked about in our community, particularly with our young Black men. And so, again, it's a different narrative, a new narrative, and that's what I wanted this book to be.
How did you come up with the questions that you articulated to the guests?
Well, man, if there was any one easy part of that, I've been doing this for 30 years, so if I had to really stumble over what kind of questions to ask, you shouldn't be talking to me today. So, obviously you do some research as relates to the topic that you want to talk about in that chapter, and you just formulate your questions. But I only had a few questions because I wanted it to read like a conversation. I wanted it really to be, if I could have had a big barbecue in the summer and invited all these people over, I wouldn't have had 10 or 12 questions in front of me. We would have just started talking about all of these things.
Right.
And in turn, the conversation would go like most conversations around the dinner table goes. Somebody interjects something, somebody says something. And so the hardest part was to make sure that I was staying true to what that person was saying in terms of how they were giving it to me, what the context was, and making sure that I was clear when I juxtaposed someone else's response that it was fair and in the context that they were giving it to me. So it wasn't out of place. And I think that we were able to do that. I haven't received any complaints from anybody yet. So we must have done all right.
Now, obviously, the book is ascertaining and trying to extract emotions and some type of thought processes. But at the end of each chapter, there are some action things that need to take place. Why was that important to be included in the book?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a funny thing about those questions. So I always wanted to say in the book that it, you know, I didn't want it to just be a conversation. Talking's fine, but action has to follow the conversation if you're going to change things. I did not like the idea of putting the questions at the back of the chapter. That was really my agent and my publisher who wanted to do that. And I will say, I will fall on my sword that we've heard from a lot of people who said they appreciated those questions at the back of the chapter because it gave them something to start on. You know, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily know how and where to start. I tell people all the time, don't wait on someone. You know, don't sit there and think that you have to have a leader to come to you and show you the way to go, that you are a leader, whether it's in your home or your neighborhood or just with yourself. There are leadership qualities we all possess. And so that was, I thought, after hearing from readers, something that was good for a lot of people who just didn't know what to look at or where to go after that. So again, I'm going to fall on my sword. I can't take full credit for that, but glad it's there.
A couple of more questions, Mr. Gordon. No, I got to let you go. Was it difficult in convincing a publisher to publish this work?
So I will say that Hachette and Christine Troutman, who was the editor of the book, who brought the book to the publishing company and said, hey, I want to do this. She saw the vision. And so she was able to articulate it. And really, she was the first company that we went to. And with her up front telling the company, this is a book that's needed, we didn't even have to go anyplace else. I'm not sure that we would have had the same reception to be honest, from other publishing companies. I don't know that, but she's a sister. And as you know, often when you have someone who really believes and really understands what a project is about, they will, you know, kind of move forward in a different way. So I was glad we didn't have to do too much shopping of it and was pleased to have, you know, a sister who got it from day one fighting for us to make it happen.
We always ask this question at the end of interviews, particularly with authors. What do you want readers to come away with?
Just a sense and a belief that, and I think, again, made easier by where we sit today, that we are in need of new narratives and that we are, you know, in control of how we act. You know, the sense of when people say the saying, control your own destiny, if you really look at the definition of destiny, you can't control that. That's going to happen no matter what. But you do have control over how you act with what the world gives to you.
Ed Gordon, Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist and author of Conversations in Black on Power, Politics, and Leadership. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.